The pandemic has left both the Democratic and Republican National Conventions this year looking pretty unconventional.
We had planned to send an army to Milwaukee for the Democratic Convention and to Charlotte for the Republican Convention. Now we're sending carloads of people.
I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Monday, August 17th, how a virtual platform can help or hurt the parties. Plus, with President Trump signing the Great American Outdoors Act, we consider the troubled history of national parks and Native communities.
The impacts are pretty severe. You know, I mean, I grew up a couple hours from the Grand Canyon National Park, and I never went because it didn't seem like a place that was there for me. And the connections that we had as Native people to these places were often severed.
And theater productions try to adjust to a socially distanced world. But first, today marks the kickoff to the 2020 Democratic National Convention. It was originally scheduled to be held in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where former Vice President Joe Biden would have accepted his party's nomination in front of tens of thousands of people. But because of the pandemic, the DNC and next week's Republican National Convention will be held almost entirely online. These virtual events mark a major departure after nearly two centuries of in-person nominating conventions.
My friends of the Democratic National Convention of 1932.
Let me say first that I accept the nomination of the Democratic Party.
With gratitude and with determination.
With a deep awareness of the responsibility conferred by your trust.
With profound gratitude,
I humbly and gratefully accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States.
Without the cheering crowds, there will certainly be a different energy this year. But not being in a physical space could also benefit party leaders. Protesters won't be visible outside the convention hall. And Democrats will be able to avoid a repeat of 2016, when Bernie Sanders supporters voiced their opposition to the party establishment during the convention. We start today considering the significance of past conventions and trying to learn what to expect from this year's new format. Joining me now is Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Thanks for being here, Susan.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Bridget.
Also with us is Marcia Barrett, Assistant Professor in the Department of History at the University of Illinois. Welcome, Marcia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Marcia, let's start with a little history lesson. When did a major political party first hold a nominating convention, and why did they opt for this format?
Well, the first convention of a major party that we would recognize, or not we, but maybe the general public, is the Democratic Party in 1832. And the rise of the convention is in part a response to the increase in popular politics in the 1820s. And there was a sense that in the period before conventions, we had congressional caucuses. So members of Congress would essentially determine, and often from the same party, would determine who would be the nominee, who would ultimately usually end up as the president. And there was a public backlash to that. And there was a sense that there should be more people, more average voters, involved in the process. So you have the rise of the convention as sort of a response to that. And at the very least, it gave the appearance that there were more people involved or more white men involved in the process.
How democratic was the convention nominating process initially?
Well, I mean, ironically, Andrew Jackson actually, you know, supported the idea of having a convention within the Democratic Party, in part because he wanted to ensure that his preferred VP nominee would be selected. And he thought he would have more control over that process in a convention. There was also institution of a two-thirds rule that would ensure, at least in his thinking, that the previous Vice President Calhoun would not be chosen. So the rise of the convention within the Democratic Party actually showed a moment where, you know, Jackson was really exerting his power over the party, and the convention was sort of the manifestation of that.
Marcia, in the late 1960s, though, it was a major shifting point for how the conventions operated. Can you tell us a little about what changed during that era?
The 1960s are a very interesting period for both the Republican and Democratic parties, in part because the parties, at least the sort of more the establishment leadership in both parties, found it more difficult to control delegates and the outcomes of and the appearance of conventions in the 1960s. First, with the Republican Party in 1964, where you have this upsurge of conservative support for Barry Goldwater that many sort of more moderate and establishment leaders in the Republican Party weren't prepared for. And then in 1968, with the Democratic Party, there was a sense that, right, you have the anti-war activists, delegates who oppose the idea of nominating Hubert Humphrey. And there's just the conventions didn't come across as a sort of as a well-organized celebration of unity within the parties. And there was a sense that some changes needed to be made. And that's sort of like why the 1960s are so important for both parties in their convention history.
And some of those reforms really changed the operation of those conventions.
It did, but in particular for the Democratic Party. So after 1968, right, there was a sense among many activist members of the Democratic Party that the party leadership and the delegates in particular didn't represent the base of the Democratic Party. So you have, there are a number of commissions, but the most well-known is the McGovern-Fraser Commission. And one of the outcomes of that is that you have sort of the process of choosing delegates changes. Delegates were then chosen in the year of the convention. Before that time period, delegates might be chosen before, and people wouldn't necessarily know who these people were or who they supported. They were typically white men. So after 1972, you see reforms where there's actually an effort by Democrats to make sure that delegates, there are more women, there are more African-Americans. So in 1968, 14% of the delegates in the Democratic Party were women. In 1972, that number jumped to 40%.
Wow.
So you see a major shift within delegates. The Republican Party did have some commissions, but ultimately didn't really institute many reforms based on them. But that's one of the major shifts. Mm-hmm. But then you also see the rise of the binding primary after 1972. And then that also changes the nominating process in a major way.
Susan, I want to bring you into this conversation. You've covered conventions dating back to 1980. How much have you noticed them evolving over the decades?
Yes, I'm very sorry that this year it will break my string of political conventions, because they are so much fun, at least for reporters and for activists. They're a real organizing opportunity for campaigns, also an opportunity for people who want to cause trouble for the candidate, as we've seen in many years, including in 2016 in the Democratic Convention. But they have changed a lot, and they've changed in importance, and I think they've also changed in impact. They're a chance for a candidate to introduce himself or herself, to explain what it is they would do if they were elected. The viewership of conventions haven't always been so strong. A lot of people don't see a reason to tune in, and yet they've remained important throughout the last couple decades, because they start the general election and they're a point where Americans who are not so very, very serious and focused on politics begin to tune in to figure out who they want to vote for in November.
So, Susan, from what we know now, what are these virtual conventions going to look like?
Well, there's a lot we don't know, and we're going to be seeing them starting Monday night. We know that there are going to be some speeches that are live, but there's going to be a lot of material that has been pre-recorded, including the speech that we're going to hear Monday night from Michelle Obama. We know that they're trying to keep things very tight. For instance, a lot of people only get 1 minute or 2 minute for speeches. That's very hard for a politician to abide by. But with a digital convention, the managers have the ability to enforce those kind of limits. And they won't have the hoopla. You know, you won't see balloon drops. You won't see cheering partisans on the arena. You won't see disenchanted party members booing or waving signs that are going to the other direction. So I think it will be a test of the ability of party organizations in these campaigns to present something that is worth watching. And we're just going to have to find out what that is.
So a test for the parties, but also a challenge for an outlet like your own. How are you planning to cover this kind of convention?
So it's so different from the previous ones. You know, we would send an army. We had planned to send an army to Milwaukee for the Democratic convention and to Charlotte for the Republican convention. Now we're sending carloads of people. I mean, there's not much to do at the convention cities, really very limited. The way we're covering it is the way Americans will be watching it. We'll be covering it off TV.
It's so interesting. Tonight, Susan, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo will be speaking at the convention. He's got a much better speaking slot than he did in 2016. How much do you anticipate he'll be focusing on his state's COVID-19 response during that appearance?
I think the number one thing the Biden campaign wants to do is keep a focus on President Trump's handling of the pandemic and questions about how well he has done and the deadly cost we've seen across the country. And Andrew Cuomo, while he has been criticized for his very initial response when the pandemic began earlier this year, he has gotten good grades, a positive assessment from his own voters and from Americans across the country for how he's done since then. And the situation in New York is so much better than it is in other big cities that we see across the country. So he is there to hammer the message that the president has failed to handle the coronavirus in a responsible way, in a way that follows the science, and that we are all dealing with both the health and the economic costs of that.
Susan, the Democrats also have some progressives speaking at their convention. They also have at least one notable Republican. Former Ohio Governor John Kasich is in their lineup. What does that tell us about how the party is navigating its moderate and progressive wings this election cycle?
Well, one thing we see this year that we didn't see 4 years is a united Democratic Party, at least until election night. You know, you see Bernie Sanders take a very different tone toward Joe Biden than he did toward Hillary Clinton, a much more positive, really encouraging his supporters to vote for the candidate who won the nomination, even though they're unhappy that that person is not Bernie Sanders. But it is hard for a party to hold together a political spectrum that runs from John Kasich, the former Republican governor of Ohio, to AOC, who is leading the rising face of Democratic socialists. So they can do that until November 3rd. And I think the real question is going to be, if Joe Biden wins the presidency, can he navigate these big ideological divisions in the White House?
So my last question to you both, do you think that conventions will ever go back to the more traditional in-person format once that's possible? Or is this really the start of a longer term shift?
So I'll go first. This is Susan. I will say no, we're not going to have old style conventions. I don't know exactly what a convention will look like in 4 years, but I suspect it will not look like a 2016 convention. And I suspect we'll learn some things in 2020 that get applied in 2024 as well.
You know, I have a slightly different perspective. I know that over the years, especially with the rise of the binding primary, people have often said that it would be the end of the convention, and they have remained. So I think that the convention is likely to change, and maybe how viewers watch a convention will change and become more diverse. But I think people do deep down enjoy the hoopla of a convention, and I think some elements of that will remain.
Susan Page is the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, and Marcia Barrett is an assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Illinois. Thanks so much to you both.
Hey, thank you, Bridget.
Thank you.
Last week, two of the five major athletic conferences announced they'd be postponing college football season and other sports over COVID-19 safety concerns. The Big Ten and Pac-12 include powerhouse sports programs like Ohio State, Michigan State, Stanford, and the University of Oregon. The remaining three athletic conferences are still on the fence, though they're expected to return to the field. But last Thursday, the NCAA announced there will not be any NCAA championship games in the fall. Let's talk about what these decisions mean for athletes, schools, and communities with Adam Silverstein, the deputy managing editor at CBS Sports. Adam, welcome to the show.
Bridget, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Adam, why do you think these major athletic conferences like the Big Ten ultimately decided to postpone?
Well, it's a great question. Really, the number one reason is most likely liability more than anything else. I think universities across the country understand that bringing students to campus simply for classes is a risk. And then asking those students, many of whom in this case are athletes, to not just go to class potentially, but also be around campus constantly, then go perform on an athletic field, which, you know, let's be honest, makes the universities millions upon millions of dollars. Honestly, it's a $1 billion industry where they don't get to see anything from that. That is a significant risk. And I think some universities, look, it's five major power conferences, as you mentioned, and each one has a different set of medical experts. And some are saying that the risks from COVID-19 are so great that, you know, not just bringing players to campus, but having them actually compete on the field is a risk not worth taking. And others feel that they're able to mitigate that risk through testing and through procedure. So right now you have the Big Ten and the Pac-12 who are kind of stepping out and saying, our medical experts feel that this is not safe for the players. And we, as universities, candidly, don't want to take the risk on bringing them out there and opening ourselves up to liabilities because the players don't want to sign any type of waiver excluding us from potential lawsuit.
We use the word postpone, but are some of these conferences that are moving forward likely to have the full fall season?
Well, it's tough to know because obviously college football has never really had a spring season before, and there's a lot to consider about moving a college football season to the spring when a lot of these players have their eyes set on becoming professional athletes, and the NFL draft every year is in April. So they're calling it a postponement because there is a hope that they're going to play in the spring. But at least to me, when I discuss it, there's no plan. There's no date. Hey, we are going to start our season now on January 15th. So for me, right now, it's a cancellation with a hope of restarting it at a later date. But there are many obstacles to playing college football in the spring. Not that it can't be done. I believe it can. There's a lot of smart people at the helm here, but it is difficult.
Up until now, how has the college sports industry overall been handling the COVID-19 pandemic?
Best they can. You know, I think right when everything hit in early March, the NCAA was about to begin the NCAA tournament. College basketball teams were in the middle of their conference tournaments. And you saw it started with the Ivy League. They canceled theirs one by one. Those conferences canceled their tournaments, and then the NCAA canceled its tournament. And very soon after, completely canceled spring sports. And that includes many other sports besides basketball, certainly baseball and softball and things like that. So they just stopped playing. And obviously many students were brought home from campuses, non-athletes as well. I think most, if not every college campus closed. So they did the best job they possibly could. But now that fall is approaching and college football is the big money maker, I believe for 80% of the FBS conferences, it is the number one sport and it comprises like 70 to 80% of their athletic budgets for the year. It's the type of sport and the type of economic driver where not that you want to take greater risk, but you're willing to see if you can make a season happen as opposed to, you know, no offense to something like volleyball that just is a money loser for almost every team in college sports.
So beyond the campus, what does the absence of college football mean for the cities and towns where the schools are located and the people who live and work there?
It's really a difficult situation for them. These small college towns, and some of them are certainly smaller than others, but they have, you're talking about dozens upon dozens of local restaurants, bars, clubs, hotels, and businesses that largely depend on the college football season when they consider their annual revenue. You know, I think many restaurants will probably tell you that, you know, 70% of their annual revenue may come just from the 4 months of the college football season. That is how many people, college football attracts to some of these towns. I was talking about something like Michigan, Ann Arbor, Michigan. They have a 100,000 seat stadium, and a lot of those people are students and people in Ann Arbor, but there's also plenty of people that drive into town from nearby cities opposing teams. They bring their fans. So these economies for these college towns are largely driven by college football, particularly in the Power Five conferences that we're discussing, and not having a season or not having fans in attendance, even for some of these conferences and teams that are having games, it's going to be detrimental to the local economies.
Was there a way to continue playing safely? You know, we're looking at sports like the NBA that have the bubble, and obviously Major League Baseball's attempting their season. Were there recommended policies or a structure for some of these sports to continue their seasons?
It's just significantly more difficult with college athletes. The NBA, NHL, and MLS, to some degree, they've created bubbles where these are professional athletes who have unions, they have players' associations, and they're able to negotiate conditions of their employment and of their play. College athletes don't have anything like that. So right off the bat, they're at a worse situation where they're not able to ensure that their needs are met in order to play. The other thing that all these leagues have, and college football has money too, but they can figure out ways to shorten their seasons and make things work where whatever money they spend for testing and for all these things, like the NBA is doing a bubble currently at Disney in Orlando, they can make sure it comes back to them. Whereas with college, they don't know what's going to happen. Not having fans, some of these stadiums pack 100,000 people. Not being able to have 100,000 people in a local economy and buying tickets, what's that going to do to your profit for the year? What's that going to do to your ability to do all the things you want to do, not just as an athletic program, but as a college institution? So it's just significantly more difficult. And then you consider that college students are college students, and they're going to want to go out and party and hang out with their friends and maybe not follow protocols the same way professional athletes, some of whom, many of whom have families, might. So you're just dealing with a different type of people and a different type of sport and in a different type of structure, being unpaid athletes versus professionals.
So just briefly, Adam, you know, giving a nod to the political season we're in, how much of a divide is there when it comes to the decisions that are being made between schools in blue states versus red states?
I think if you were to look at a map of which states have schools and conferences that are not playing and those that are, it would fall very similar to the electoral map. It's not exact, but the college football is very big in the South, and the Southern conferences as of right now are the ones that are still playing.
Adam, many college football programs are really critical to the financial sustainability of colleges and universities. With some already struggling financially because of COVID-19, how does this decision further exacerbate those impacts?
Absolutely. I mean, there are some that do have nonprofit, somewhat private athletic departments, but many of them are integrated within the university, and losing dollars to the athletic budget, which is what football brings in, not just through ticket sales and concessions, but also television contracts with the major networks, losing that money, it hurts basically the athletic department's ability to put on the other quote unquote non-revenue sports. Again, things like gymnastics, volleyball, swimming. But it also, you know, depending on how the university utilizes the funds brought in through football and through athletics, it could affect other departments, scientific research or journalism or whatever the case. So, you know, college football is a major money driver, and there's plenty of universities across this country that it may be their number one driver outside of endowments, you know, or even maybe more than that for certain universities.
Considering what it means for student athletes, what about athletic scholarships? Are those in jeopardy?
As of right now, I would not consider those in jeopardy. It seems as if the NCAA is set to basically guarantee scholarships for players, whether they do or do not play this particular year. Many schools, in fact, I believe it's most at this point, have guaranteed scholarships for student athletes at this point. So I do not believe athletes have any need to worry or be concerned about if they choose not to play this year for conferences that are operating, or if their conferences canceled their sport or postponed it with a to-be-determined date. At this time, they don't need to worry about whether they'll be able to complete their degrees or at least, you know, be able to attend college this year or next year.
Adam, have we been seeing a divide between students who want to play versus those who don't? I understand Ohio State's quarterback Justin Fields has started a petition requesting the Big Ten to reinstate this season. Are there many athletes backing him?
There are. I believe that it has over 200,000 signatures right now, and that's not just athletes, that's fans and parents and so on and so forth. But, you know, I think just like any other demographic, there's plenty of students who believe sports should not be played, just like there's plenty of students who believe that they shouldn't be in classes or they shouldn't be back on campus. And I think depending on the university and depending on the student and the makeup of that population, you're going to get different opinions. But there are plenty of players, big name players, who are going to be drafted or selected in the NFL draft this coming April that have already opted out of the season. This was before conferences even canceled games or decided not to play. So, you know, there are plenty that understand the risks and don't want to take them, but there's also plenty others, probably the majority, that want to play this season.
Adam, in our last minute, what do you think this moment will mean for the future of college athletics?
I don't think college athletics will ever be the same, and I don't know that it's going to happen immediately, but inside of the next 5 years, you're going to notice that the players have found their voice, which is something that has been a long time coming, and they're going to be able to fight for things they need. And I think universities and the NCAA are going to have to start listening.
Adam, thank you so much. Adam Silverstein is the deputy managing editor at CBS Sports. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
President Trump signed the Great American Outdoors Act into law earlier this month, a bipartisan piece of legislation funding the maintenance of our national parks, as well as the Land and Water Conservation Fund. All this week, we'll be talking about our national parks and public spaces. Later in the week, you'll hear more about the Great American Outdoors Act and the future of conservation of precious natural places in the U.S. But today, we start at the beginning, when many of our national parks were created by kicking Native Americans off their own land. Tanzina recently sat down with Len Nesifer, Assistant Professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona. He's also the CEO and founder of Natives Outdoors. Tanzina and Len talked about the history of national parks and American Indian communities.
I think the broader discussion is how we created public lands. With westward expansion and manifest destiny, many tribes were being displaced from their homelands. And with the removal and the acquisition of these Indian lands, there was this competing, basically, tension to, you know, how do you manage this in light of all the settlers that want to come west? So the federal government developed what we know as the federal public land system that we have now, which includes the national parks and national forests and Bureau of Land Management land and the many other agencies that have land holdings. But alongside of that was the creation of the Federal Indian Reservation System, known as Federal Indian Trust Land. And one of the big things that occurred after that is that there was a lot of laws that prohibited Indian people from returning to their ancestral homelands and what was now national parks.
So when Native peoples were removed from this land, what happened to them? Where did they go?
Many died, either through warfare, disease, and some were placed into internment camps. Like my people, the Navajo, we were placed into an internment camp in eastern New Mexico, and others were moved to reservations, sometimes in Oklahoma, sometimes in sort of the lands that were not predisposed for farming or other sorts of productive activities. And then often tribes were placed alongside other tribes that were their enemies. And the intention there with the U.S. government was actually to just foment warfare and sort of expedite the extermination of Native people.
In the beginning of the late 1800s, the majority of national parks already began to prohibit hunting and fishing. How did that affect Indigenous Americans?
You know, it's a multitude of ways. You know, it wasn't just, you know, hunting and fishing was one of the ways in which they saw the U.S. government kind of saw man and nature as separate, and Native peoples were not seen as a piece of these places either. But, you know, of course, the hunting and fishing element obviously had undertones to keep Native people out, but it was also practicing traditional religions as well. And it wasn't until 1978 and the passage of the American Indian Religious Freedoms Act that Native people were actually even legally able to practice their traditional religions on public lands. But, you know, in many ways, these laws and policies that were implemented by national parks and other sorts of public land systems were intended to keep Native people out. And the impacts are pretty severe. You know, I mean, I grew up a couple hours from the Grand Canyon National Park, and I never went because it didn't seem like a place that was there for me. And it was another way in which, you know, there was this, the connections that we had as Native people to these places were often severed.
The First Amendment ensures religious freedom in the country, but did the creation of national parks affect that religious freedom of poor Indigenous communities?
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of the arguments that a lot of, up until 2009, there was a court case over Forest Service management that basically said that giving preference to any sort of Native religions on federal land is a violation of the Establishment Clause, the separation of church and state. And, you know, the First Amendment definitely did not apply, and in many cases still does not apply to Native people in this country. So, you know, yeah, I mean, it was definitely in how parks are managed, how the different laws that kept Native people out. I mean, definitely it was an element of, you know, violated our rights as citizens of this country as well.
A lot of the history of what we know as our national parks and even more broadly of nature conservatism has often been led or documented by white Americans, featuring white Americans. One of the things that we're exploring here on The Takeaway is the erasure of people of color from the history of the founding of many of these parks. Is there any recognition of the history that Native Americans or American Indians have in their relation to the national parks, or has it all but been erased?
It's pretty spotty. You know, there's some national parks near reservations that highlight those histories pretty well. And employ folks from the tribes in the area. There's others that I've been to where I know that there's 10,000 years of human history, and I talked to a superintendent one instance, and they said, well, we're not a human history park. Yeah, I mean, it's very spotty and very mixed. And the thing is that many of these landscapes were shaped by Native stewardship. I mean, you can look at Yosemite, and in the valley floor, the Awanichi people actually would burn the valley floor in order to increase the productivity of oak trees because acorns were their main source of food. And now the relic of that is that we have these huge open meadows and sort of that iconic landscape that John Muir kind of described as a park. And he said, though, this had, you know, there was no sort of hand of Native people in this sort of beauty. But in reality, you have six to 10 to 20,000 years of interaction. You know, that history is just written into the landscape. And I think there could be a lot more done to highlight that history as well.
We've also been experiencing a moment in the United States, I'd say more than a moment. It's been at least a couple of years now, but particularly this summer, we saw a renewed interest in examining and in many cases removing statues and other landmarks in this country of people who committed atrocities in the United States. And you know, many of the landmarks within Yellowstone and other national parks also have names of men who committed atrocities against indigenous populations. What do we know about whether or not those remain and whether or not there is an effort to remove them or rename them?
I mean, the history of all of this becomes even more complex when we talk about Indian removal. You know, in cases like Yosemite or other places, you know, the Buffalo Soldiers were actually a critical component of Indian removal. And in case of, like, say, the Apache, they had a lot of pitched battles and wars to remove them from their homelands. And, like, you know, that becomes like kind of this complex piece of this puzzle of, like, you know, who do we kind of remove and who do we, you know, like, who do we keep? And I think that's kind of where one of the discussions around, say, like Yosemite, where the Buffalo Soldiers were very key to basically being the first park rangers. The question then begs of, like, who are they keeping out? But the other thing is that you can have other folks that have, you know, you can go, you know, basically go up the gradient of spiciness when it comes to this. And you have folks like Kit Carson, who are memorialized in different places. And Kit Carson, for example, was the general that led the removal and basically placed my people into an internment camp for close to 5 years. I've heard some, you know, and those are just histories that are just dotted through all the landscapes. You know, nearly every high point or peak in every state has some name that points to some sort of military general. And in terms of the discussion that's happening around that, I had a couple discussions with some senators from Oregon about the potential of looking at what are problematic names and can they be changed. And I think that's an important step. I would say, like, right now, at this point in time, it's fairly nascent, and actually not much has happened comparatively with, like, say, Civil War or Confederate monuments.
You know, the Trump administration has essentially, you know, in many ways gutted a lot of the Department of the Interior, and the Bureau of Land Management has been affected, and many of the environmental laws that were put into place, or policies that were put into place under President Obama and other administrations, have been at least temporarily halted under this administration. When you see all of that, are you concerned about the future of not just our environment, but also these national parks and the sort of disconnect between the real history and what we know today?
You know, I actually testified to a House subcommittee last summer on some BLM leasing stuff. And, you know, one of the things that I was sure to mention is that, you know, Native people we've been through quite a lot. And, you know, one of the sentiments I've heard from a lot of Native folks is, like, we've been through way worse than what we see with the Trump administration now, and we're going to survive and come out the other end. And what we see now in the short term is incredibly bad, but I think it's creating alliances between groups of people that historically have not worked together. The coalition building that's happening between, you know, large players in the outdoor space, whether it's companies or professional athletes and other marginalized communities, it's just growing stronger in light of this. And I think once this sort of storm is over, I think there's going to be a big shift to sort of creating the future that we wish to see. In the short term, it's kind of scary, but I think there's a lot that can be done to sort of set things on a stronger course in decades to come.
Len Nesifer is an assistant professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona and the CEO and founder of Natives Outdoors. Len, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
All good gifts around us are sent from heaven above.
That was from a rehearsal for a new production of Godspell that's currently being staged outdoors by the Berkshire Theater Group in Western Massachusetts. It's one of the first union-approved theatrical productions since the pandemic began. And although the performance might sound normal, for audience members going to the show in person, there are plenty of reminders that we're still in a pandemic. Cast members wear masks when passing each other on the stage and sing behind vinyl partitions, and seats for different groups of attendees are spaced out by at least 6 feet. Meanwhile, in New York City, Broadway theaters remain closed at least through the end of this year. and a sign of how much the pandemic has altered the theater landscape, producers for the musical Diana announced last week that a filmed version of the show will premiere on Netflix before its Broadway opening planned for next year. For more, I'm joined by Maya Phillips, arts critic fellow for the New York Times. Welcome to The Takeaway, Maya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also with us is Helen Shaw, theater critic for New York Magazine. Thanks for joining us, Helen.
Hi, good to be here.
So, Helen, unlike Godspell, most theater productions have actually been happening online during the pandemic. Which virtual shows have you been most impressed by?
I think I've been most impressed by the shows that have worked out some measure of interactivity. There are productions that have managed to make the audience into a jury, so we have to vote on the outcome of the production, or a magic show in which the company mails you through the physical mail a box of cards so that you can participate in the magic show yourself. And that kind of contact in a time when contact is almost a special effect has, for me, had the biggest effect.
Maya, what do you think has worked well when it comes to virtual theater?
I totally agree with Helen. I think that has been an exciting part of the online productions that, you know, you haven't been able to see in live productions. It's definitely a new way to interact with the form. And I think that people playing around with the technology, using different backgrounds, using Zoom to the advantage. Early on in the pandemic, people were still kind of getting used to the form, and there were some glitches and there were some problems. But I think now at this point, people are really taking advantage of it and being really creative with that.
And Maya, what do you think hasn't worked as well when it comes to bringing the theater online?
I'm a little bit disappointed in some productions that might be a little bit safe. I think this is a great opportunity for companies to really try to take risks and consider what theater can be now, what theater is now, and what theater can be in the future.
Helen, are there any outdoor shows happening in New York City right now?
There are a few that are coming up. There's a piece that's going to be in a garden in Bushwick called Quince on the 21st and 22nd. And then there are a few shows which are programmed so that you experience them yourself as you walk through some sort of urban environment. So there's a show called Cairns, which is actually an album that you download, and then you listen to it as you walk through Greenwood Cemetery. Mm. And so you sort of make the production yourself, you cast yourself, and they do the sound. And that, for me, has been very rich. The shows where you go to a community garden and only 13 people can be admitted per day, I think is more, I'm almost more delighted that it's happening than that I'll be able to get there. Because I actually don't know how I can get to some of the places that they want us to go.
You know, for you both, theater tickets tend to be very expensive, especially here in New York. And I'm wondering, how has this move into online spaces affected the accessibility of theater?
Yeah, I think it's an amazing opportunity for a new model if we're able to sustain this, that it's another way for people to get access to theater at a, you know, at a better cost. And if I would love to see a model where when things get back to normal, whatever that is, that we have the live performances, and they also have an option for people who may not be able to afford the live performance rates to kind of have a cheaper rate and just access it from their homes or wherever they are. Because that's been, I think that's amazing. I mean, just Hamilton obviously is a great example of that, that so many people who weren't able to get Hamilton tickets suddenly can watch it on Disney Plus.
Exactly. Amazing. And Helen, what do you think?
Well, I also teach theater. And this past spring, I had a class where every other class, we would do a normal virtual class, meaning that we would meet sort of in community and discuss. And then on the off weeks, we would have an asynchronous class in which I would videotape something and they would react to it and they would write their own material, which means that they could interact with the class material at midnight on a Wednesday, whenever they wanted. And for me, that has been the great thing about what we're seeing with the theater as well, which is that these two modes complement each other, that going to a space and sitting together is incredibly precious, and we all miss it very much. Mm. But the country is very large, and art is very concentrated, and that being able to access it asynchronously, being able to watch, in my case yesterday, a bootleg video of The Dance of the Vampires from 2002, you know, whatever your choice might be, is that it is still engagement, it's still art response, and it still does things to your mind that you want art to do. And so I'm hoping that we will move into a phase where we do both things, where we're on parallel tracks.
Maya, as in many industries, there's been a renewed attention this summer on addressing racism and issues of representation in the theater world. Are there signs yet that the theater industry is listening?
I mean, it's hard to tell at this point, just because a lot of institutions have made statements so far, but in general, this doesn't even apply to just theater. Just institutions across the board have made statements about their commitment to making change, but we're not going to see whether or not they'll actually follow through on that until things get back to normal. And I fear that institutions will kind of go back into their old patterns, because it's a hard task, because this means that the people in charge have to hold themselves accountable. It means that a lot of these places have to totally restructure, have to totally rethink the way they work their organizations, and that's not an easy task.
Helen, as we mentioned, Diana is going to Netflix before a planned Broadway run. In our last minute, do you think more shows are going to follow suit?
They would be insane not to. This is the way we feed appetite now, and we need to drive appetite for an art form that will be in real distress. And I think that if somebody sees Diana and loves it on Netflix, that they will absolutely come to the city to see it for real.
I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Helen Shaw is the theater critic for New York Magazine, and Maya Phillips is an arts critic fellow for the New York Times. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I'll be with you guys all week, so I hope you enjoy the shows we have planned. You can give us a call about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also send me a tweet at Bridget Bergen. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.